Good morning, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded, July the 3rd, 2014. I would now like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Dr. Helen Winter. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good morning. And I'm delighted to join you here from the UK. And I'm sorry that you can't see me, but probably that's just as well after the long journey that I've had to get here. The theme of this talk is an update on lung cancer. And what I really want to do is to provide some information on the recent advances there have been in the management of non-small cell lung cancer. As this is a whistle-stop tour of lung cancer, and obviously in the interest of time, I have to be quite selective in what I'm presenting today, I've illustrated my talk with quotes from the five countries I've been to in the last 5 days, which have been in my own whistle-stop tour, bringing me back from New Zealand to the UK. I'm Helen Winter, a medical oncologist who's been working for the last 8.5 years at the Regional Cancer Treatment Service. Prior to that, I trained in London and had the privilege of looking after lung cancer patients in London, Australia, and obviously more recently in New Zealand. It's been a real privilege to look after these patients, and a few of whom you will hear about today. Many of these patients have generously allowed me to tell their stories, either through video or as case studies, and they've taught me and hopefully many others so much about what it's like to be a patient with lung cancer. Before we start, just a word on smoking cessation and obviously the links with lung cancer. Most of the lung cancer we see is smoking related. However, a number of patients that we see will have never smoked. And although today we're focusing on the molecular biology and new therapeutic agents, I think it's important to mention the importance of smoking cessation and the earlier detection of lung cancer and the contributions both these will have now and in the future to improving outcomes for our lung cancer patients. Just a note on working with patient advocacy groups. It was a real privilege to attend the World Lung Cancer Conference in Sydney and in Darling Harbour attend an event about shining the light on lung cancer. And it was refreshing to hear there that there really should be no distinction between patients with lung cancer, whether they've been smokers or not, and adopting the expression, no one deserves lung cancer. Time does not allow me to discuss the role of smoking cessation in more detail, and I'll not refer to it again, but I think it's important as healthcare professionals that this message is still promoted and obviously highlighted wherever we can in the management of our patients with cancer. So on to slide 2 and our learning objectives. After speaking with colleagues from palliative care and wondering what would be the most important to get out of this session, I've split it up into four key objectives. Understanding why the histology of lung cancer is so important, and that lung cancer can no longer be considered as a single entity. It should be, in fact, considered as a heterogeneous group of disorders, and it's true that lung cancers are not all the same. The most important clinical treatment in New Zealand as a recent development has been the availability of epidermal growth factor receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors. A long sentence, but really these represent a new form of oral therapy, targeted therapy, that are used in EGFR-positive or mutated lung cancer. And I will be touching on this in a bit more detail as it's an important new therapy for treatment. I therefore think if this is a new treatment and patients will be shared with palliative care, that we consider the common side effects of these new treatments, which you will obviously be less familiar with than patients on chemotherapy. These new targeted therapies are commonly seen in patients now with breast cancer, renal cancer, and gastrointestinal cancers, and the side effect profile is very different, as we shall see. It may be interesting to also consider the integral nature of palliative care and how closely we obviously all work together, and some interesting research there has been as the impact of good palliative care, and also the consideration of where there may be room for improvement. So with that in mind, let's make a start. I really like this quote. This first quote is from a Chinese proverb, and I think this really sums up the importance of histology in all our management of cancer, but particularly in lung cancer. So outside of curative approaches with resection or chemo radiation, the three options for advanced lung cancer include systemic therapy, radiation, or palliative and best supportive care. And many of the patients will undergo all three at the same point in their disease trajectory. Classically, oncologists have personalized their treatment on clinical and pathological features, as well as the performance status and patient wishes. Interestingly, when I was reading an article on a scientific review of personalized treatment of lung cancer, patients' wishes and shared decision-making was not mentioned. However, with the new molecular biological exploration, we're now basing our treatment decisions much more on tailoring therapies to the molecular profile and not just the histological diagnosis. These so-called biomarkers will be discussed in more detail later. So historically, as we can see on the slide, we have divided lung cancer into small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. And essentially, that's what the cells look like down the microscope. As we have become more sophisticated, we're now looking at these molecular subtypes. We can see that this old distinction in terms of management of small cell from non-small cell lung cancer is still important. But it's in the case of non-small cell lung cancer that's undergone a significant drilling down of both the histological and molecular subtyping. For practical purposes, I'm going to highlight the most clinically relevant molecular subtypes, that of EGFR, but also the emerging data on ALK fusion, also known as EML4 or ALK subtype. The names are probably not important, but it's the fact that these exist and can now be used as targets for new therapy. And these are found in the adenocarcinoma subtype of non-small cell lung cancer. So you can see now that the beginning of wisdom really is to call things by their right name, because without actually specifying what type of lung cancer we're dealing with, it's very difficult to actually select the right therapy for the patient. So if we consider, and I'm going on to slide four now, the small cell cancer, this really is quite a quick thing to update, as essentially there's very little new data for small cell lung cancer. There has certainly been more molecular work and molecular signatures and new changes in what small cell or how it can be defined. But essentially, in terms of our management, we're still where we were many, many years ago. As we can see on this slide, small cell lung cancer is characterized by the extent of disease and managed accordingly to this distinction. Limited stage is, and practically the question we ask in our lung MDT, is can this be encompassed by a radiation field within the lung? And then the ideal treatment would be that the patient is offered chemotherapy along with radiation. Ideally, and to get the best clinical outcomes, that is done concurrently, usually practically starting with the second cycle of chemotherapy. But we also see improved benefits if the radiotherapy is done afterwards to the hopefully responding area, usually just within one lung. We also see that in extensive stage, a platinum doublet of chemotherapy, commonly carboplatin, but it doesn't really matter about the name, but it means two agents of chemotherapy are given. And again, this is with palliative nature, with a palliative intent. And as the name suggests, this is people with very, very extensive disease in an advanced stage. Our preferred approach is one of systemic therapy, because these tumours tend to be very fast-growing, and sometimes people only give you a history of feeling unwell for several weeks rather than months and certainly not years, then it does tend to be initially very chemosensitive. So we can see some very dramatic and good responses, but these may be short-lived. The role of PCI, or prophylactic cranial irradiation, has been shown to have a survival advantage for patients with small cell lung cancer, which commonly metastasizes or recurs in the brain. It used to be the case that in limited stage patients who've had a good response to their treatment, the role of brain irradiation, along with the toxicities, has been shown to be advantageous. More recently, in extensive stage patients who are obviously more palliative in nature, the role of PCI in people who are responding and remain fit is has certainly got an advantage as well. And that's really one of the newest things that's come into a standard of care in our practice. I just think to illustrate the impact of chemotherapy as a palliative, as a form of palliative care, I wanted to just share a couple of stories. It was a couple of years ago that I got a call from a local surgeon whether to biopsy a chap with a liver full of metastases and a bilirubin of 170. He was 91, extremely fit, and really wanted to know what was wrong with him. Clearly, at 91, with a very deranged liver function and a failing performance status, the options for any active treatment were extremely limited. But we discussed it, and we said that we would go ahead with a biopsy because in the small chance that this was either a lymphoma that can be chemosensitive or something else, and really that he would find knowing what this would be helpful, although certainly a liver biopsy in a chap like this would be not without risks. Anyway, it happened that the man wanted to come and meet me, and so he came over to Palmerston North, and I indeed agreed that he was a really fit 91-year-old, and he'd really made a very informed decision about this. We didn't have the results of the biopsy, but we talked about the fact that this was most likely something that certainly wasn't going to be cured and was unlikely to be helped by chemotherapy. But we would wait and see what the final histology was, remembering the Chinese proverb. And sure enough, the next day I got a phone call from the surgeon to say, hey, this was actually small cell. Now, it hadn't actually originated in the lung, but that's really incidental. And the fact was that this was a highly aggressive cancer that was taking up most of his liver and certainly would have caught up with him in a very short period of time. And so we got him back and said, what do you want to do? Because without treatment, you're certainly not going to live very long. And there was nothing stentable in his liver. The liver was deranged due to very severe disease. So we started him on a bit of steroid, and then rather than a platinum doublet, we just used one drug, a very modified, gentle dose, with quite some trepidation. But I was delighted when 6 months later he came back to see me, and I'd been seeing him obviously monthly throughout the chemotherapy, with a normal bilirubin and a liver that was certainly looking a lot healthier. And he was certainly feeling better and had the benefits of a very good 6 months. His son had come back from England, and he was also preparing his wife for a time when he wasn't going to be around. He gave permission for a junior doctor to present his case at a cancer conference examining chemotherapy in the elderly, and he was very keen to emphasize that older patients shouldn't be discriminated, but obviously we need caution. It reminded me of a chap that I'd seen in my training when I was in Australia and deciding whether to be a medical oncologist. And we came across a much younger chap, a chap in his 50s, who was bedbound jaundiced with extensive stage small cell lung cancer. A lot of the staff and the clinical staff looked at my colleague my boss, who has now become a mentor, when he suggested that he wanted to get on with chemotherapy. They thought this was an extreme measure and absolutely hopeless. But the patient made an informed decision to commence treatment. And the last thing I heard, he was discharged to the hospice, either to await any response to chemotherapy or to pass away. I was absolutely delighted to hear several weeks later that he was actually doing the gardening there. He was still treated with palliative intent, but he certainly got some good quality of life and certainly an improved length of life with this treatment. So I guess the message to say about small cell lung cancer is there's the distinction about the role of radiation if it's limited stage, the role of prophylactic cranial radiation to stop brain metastases or to lengthen the time to brain metastases certainly has a role, and that we certainly need new treatments. And really the treatments have not changed, certainly in the last 10 or 15 years. But the learning from these cases also reflected to me that we shouldn't make assumptions about who, not only who may benefit, but also who may actually want active treatment. And that was a good lesson for me. Now, coming to the remainder of my presentation, so this is slide 5. And on that, you will see that we have the original or historical differentiation of non-small cell lung cancer into squamous at the top and adeno. And unfortunately for patients with squamous cell carcinoma, the standard of care in New Zealand remains a platinum doublet. We actually use a slightly different second agent, but carboplatin, as mentioned with the small cell. There's also the role of palliative radiation, which can absolutely be a godsend for patients with painful metastases or large obstructing tumours. However, in terms of developments and actually bringing into the clinical care, little has changed in the management of these patients. However, what I want to concentrate on for the next little while is the role of new treatments in adenocarcinoma. The standard of care, again, is a platinum doublet where other molecular targets aren't expressed. There's an interesting role of a new drug called pemetrexed, which is funded for mesothelioma in New Zealand through ACC for people with asbestos exposure, but unfortunately is yet funded for non-small cell lung cancer. And the reason why this is exciting is it has been shown to have increased sensitivity in patients with adenocarcinoma, and it tends to be more well tolerated than some of the other chemotherapy agents that we see. But the most dramatic turnabout for lung cancer into the clinical setting has been the identification of EGFR mutation-positive lung cancers, predominantly in adenocarcinoma, and more recently, ALK fusion mutations. And this really has been a dramatic turnabout for oncologists in dealing with lung cancer. And I'm just going to say why this was needed, because over 80% of people with non-small cell lung cancer present at an advanced stage, and those getting to 5 years with a diagnosis of lung cancer is still only in the region of 10%. In the last decade, there's been a plethora of the trials that I'm not going to go into, but would be happy to provide information if people wanted, about trying different agents for lung cancer. Many of them are still unfunded in New Zealand. But the key message is that there are new options coming, not only for the EGFR subtype, but also for newer targets. And these have both prognostic, i.e. determining how long somebody may live, but also predictive benefits, that is, predicting the ability to respond to a treatment. Now, I'm moving on to slide 7, and this is the only bit of molecular biology I'm going to show you. And this really looks at the EGFR receptor, which you can see there on the outside of the cell, and shows that when there's binding to the EGFR receptor, a number of processes, including proliferation, suppression of apoptosis or cell death, cell motility, and angiogenesis are put into play. And these are really the hallmarks of cancer and certainly of developing metastases. And therefore, by blocking on the inside of this membrane and the inside of the receptor with a TKI, that really stands for a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, or these oral drugs that we're going to come on to talk to, you can see how these would work by inhibiting those carcinogenic processes. EGFR has been shown to be dysregulated by many mechanisms in non-small cell lung cancer, including mutation, overexpression, and amplification of this receptor. This diagram depicts that role of how the TKIs inhibit this pathway and stop these mechanisms. The drugs practically that we use in New Zealand that are funded are erlotinib and gefitinib, and we're delighted that they are now both funded in New Zealand, as it's now international standard of care that patients with adenocarcinoma are not only tested for EGFR, but also are offered an EGFR receptor inhibitor as a first-line treatment for their lung cancer. So that really heralds a new departure from what we were traditionally doing, which was giving everybody with lung cancer, if they were fit enough and of a good performance status, chemotherapy. Many studies, as I said, have demonstrated a lot, and there's a huge volume of work about EGFR receptors. In the early trials, certain patient characteristics were associated with increased EGFR mutation and therefore a response to treatment. But despite these observations that more commonly Asian women who were non-smokers were more likely to have an EGFR mutation and therefore respond, As I've said, the standard of care is that all patients with non-squamous adenocarcinoma of the lung should be tested for this mutation. We were fortunate before these drugs became funded that we thought that they may have a role to play in improving outcomes in lung cancer, and particularly in Maori patients who have a very poor outcome from lung cancer in New Zealand. We were lucky enough to get an HRC grant and explore the perceptions of patients with lung cancer from our Maori population about the role of EGFR testing. And we were delighted that there was a lot of support for actually exploring this, and that they certainly felt that this would be something that hopefully, even if it didn't benefit them directly, would help future generations with lung cancer. This really was on the background of the several excellent reports by Wendy Stevens and her group from Auckland looking at the management of lung cancer in New Zealand, and particularly a very interesting report on the ethnic variations in both the management and outcomes for lung cancer, which really showed a huge disparity. We are still yet to know whether the hypothesis of Maori patients would have a higher EGFR mutation rate in their cancers and potentially have the most to gain from the first-line treatment with TKIs, but it's absolutely pleasing that since that research was set up, both EGFR treatment and EGFR testing is now funded in New Zealand. Now let's talk about side effects. And we can't have any benefits from anything we do without a risk of side effects. And although people might think that a tablet, well, that's easy, as we are finding out and increasingly finding out with these newer targeted therapies, there's certainly some thorns to go along with this. So this is moving on to slide 8. The rash is the most common side effect of these, but we're actually seeing and discovering new side effects with these treatments and also new ways of managing them. So this is just a slide that illustrates the more common side effects in red from carboplatin and paclitaxel compared to Erisa, which is the drug, the company name for gefitinib, but it could as well reflect alotinib. And what we see that there's certainly the side effect profile with returns to low blood count, nerve loss, nausea, certainly seem to be favoring the tablet treatment. So if you were offered in first-line treatment with a TKI in the green or a chemotherapy with the red, not only do we think there's a higher response rate, but actually that people will tolerate the treatment. Then if we look on the downside, the more common side effects of the oral treatment compared to chemotherapy, we will see that skin changes and diarrhea are particularly dominant. And those are the things that people most commonly will present and certainly may present to you in the community, that they've got a GI toxicity and significant changes in their hands or an acneiform rash. And so how to manage the rash? Although we are used to seeing reactions with chemotherapy and skin toxicity with chemotherapy, this rash is certainly different. And this is just a slide to show that there is an algorithm to how to manage this rash. And you will see that there may be something just as simple as topical steroids, but more commonly if the rash continues, and I'm now moving on to slide 12 for a moderate rash, that the use of antibiotics, particularly doxycycline or minocycline, may be helpful, and that patients may need to stop the treatment depending on how they tolerate it, particularly if they go on to develop a severe rash. And certainly this can be very distressing. In another targeted therapy that's used in bowel cancer, you can literally get thousands of pustules on your face. And when you're facing a shortened life expectancy, deciding whether to live with that, even if the treatment's working, is certainly a very difficult consideration. So I guess the important part of this is that there are new tablet treatments that do herald an exciting time for the management of lung cancer, but they do come at a cost. And although rash doesn't sound significant, when you suddenly develop an acneiform rash from head to toe, particularly on the trunk and on the face, this certainly can be difficult for patients. I guess the thing to say is that this is not all bad, because it has been shown that often the development of a rash has been associated with an increased response. So sometimes that makes living with a rash a bit easier. But we shouldn't underestimate the new side effect profile of these tablet targeted therapies. I don't think it's a lot easier to manage than chemotherapy. And because the patient's taking them at home, it can sometimes be quite difficult to convince people to stop them, even when they've got quite significant toxicity. If we just touch on targeted therapies for things like renal cell cancer, because that's all recently came in at the same time, we also see that hypertension is a very significant problem. And so we are asking people, checking and ensuring that their blood pressure is near normal when they start these treatments and need almost weekly blood pressure. And certainly that has need dose modification. And again, when people may be responding to a treatment or certainly be holding their hopes on treatment, it's very hard to convince them that actually if we don't take care of their blood pressure, we could end up even shortening their life if they're at risk of a stroke. So I would just draw your attention, not particularly that is seen with these treatments for lung cancer, but the other targeted therapies, that there is a new side effect profile, and we will be commonly asking people to have blood pressure measures, thyroid function, liver function, and even though they rarely cause thrombocytopenia and low white cell counts, it's still very important because you do see it in selected cases. So for the last part of the talk, I just want to spend a few minutes talking about palliation. As I've said, over 80% of our patients in New Zealand will present with advanced lung cancer. And even those that are treated with either chemotherapy and or targeted therapy, unfortunately, cancer is still outwitting us, and we see that acquired resistance occurs. In EGFR mutated lung cancer, we've already identified a common acquired resistance. It's called T790M for people who are interested. And they're now looking at targeting this mutation to see whether we can overcome drug resistance to EGFR inhibitors with a second drug. However, as I've said, despite all these advances, it's still largely a terminal disease. And about 1,500 people in New Zealand will die annually. Lung cancer is also the leading cause of cancer death in New Zealand, and as I've said, a source of health inequality. Worldwide, the mortality rate is high, but I would draw your attention to New Zealand. There's a very poor five-year survival rate, with only about 10% of people living for five years following a diagnosis of lung cancer. So therefore, palliative care and symptom control are integral and essential to the management of the majority of advanced lung cancer patients prior to their inevitable death if they're presenting with advanced stage. Many of you, I'm sure, will be familiar with the study reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, which explored this interface. And I just want to talk for a moment on that. The indicators of poor quality end-of-life care in this study were a high rate of hospitalization, visits to the emergency department within the last few weeks of life, a death in hospital, or receipt of chemotherapy within 2 weeks. 2 weeks of death. Now, I'm not going to debate whether these are really considered poor quality end-of-life care things. Certainly, hospitalization and death in hospital may be necessary and may be highly satisfactory for people, but that was what was used. And what it did show was the benefits from early implementation of palliative care, and that showed that there was improved quality of life. There was a less aggressive end-of-life care, that there were greater documentation of resuscitation preference and other important planning of end-of-life care, that less patients were given chemotherapy within 14 days of life. And as a medical oncologist, I'm certainly very disappointed if we have been treating people up and, you know, towards the very last stages of their death. But possibly the most unexpected observation was the longer survival that we're seeing. And there's been lots of debates as to why that is. But certainly the benefits of survival that we're seeing in terms of 8.9 months compared to the intervention group with early palliative care, and this is from the States, of 11.6 months, is as dramatic, or perhaps one would argue more dramatic, than any chemotherapy benefit that we've seen. This led to an interesting study from a group in Canada that explored this a little bit further and presented it at the World Lung Cancer Conference last year. And they wanted to explore, or their primary goal was to examine the use of institution and community resources within the last 3 months of life. So again, they have a different setup to the state, but their interest was really triggered by the study that had taken place. And what they also wanted to look at was the place of death, hospitalizations and the visit to the emergency department, the documentation of treatment preferences, the place of death, and the transition and the intervention of that transition from active treatment to palliative care. Their baseline statistics had showed that 75% of people with lung cancer had visited the emergency department in the last 3 months of their life. And I have to say, none patients really enjoy visiting the emergency department. And I think that this is something that they certainly wanted to improve on. So they did a retrospective cohort study of approximately 300 patients. This is in Canada in two centres. And what they found was that 50% of their lung cancer patients had a hospital death, about 20% people died at home, and another 20% or similar in the hospice. And they found that about 7% of people had chemotherapy in the last 14 days. They also find that they did have a high rate of hospitalization and emergency department attendances within the last 3 months of life. Now, we know that there are always going to be the need for hospital attendances and certainly trips to ED for some patients. But I think that we could all agree that the initial figure of 75% attending ED in the last few weeks of life would certainly be something that hopefully we don't see in New Zealand, but we certainly could improve on. And what they established was that the early involvement of a hospice care meant that patients were less likely to go to emergency departments, that their symptom management was much improved. They also looked at the main reasons why people were, and shortness of breath was one of the key aspects, and I'm sure we can all identify with that. And then they made some recommendations about how they could improve things, and one of them was introducing protocols for the management of shortness of breath, and actually some education strategies to improve that. And I think just highlighting that high rates of hospitalization and emergency department visits were something that needed to be improved upon. So I thought that was a very interesting follow-up study to the initial New England study. So I guess in summary, I seem to have been speaking for quite a long time and said quite a lot. But I think the key messages of what we've talked about is that lung cancer is changing. And I would argue that the nihilistic approach to managing lung cancer, even though most people will die from their lung cancer, is changing and should be supported. I hope that we've highlighted that histology is important, that there are subgroups of patients that do have different benefits from treatment, will benefit from different treatments, and may live longer or indeed shorter than the average person, and that we need to better identify those patients for selecting treatments, but also, for example, involving palliative care very early in those patients who we may not do very well. In EGFR-positive adenocarcinomas, I hope I've highlighted that the first-line treatment should be a targeted therapy such as gefitinib or erlotinib, and that chemotherapy is not now considered the best option for these patients first line. But indeed, they may develop this they may be offered chemotherapy as a second line treatment. So just if you hear somebody's been on a targeted therapy, do not be surprised if they remain of a reasonable performance status. And by that, I mean 0 to 1 and possibly 2, where they're still up and about more than 50% of the time or doing light jobs and still looking active. We certainly wouldn't give chemotherapy second line to someone who has bedbound, except in the case of small cell lung cancer, where I alluded to with that case from Australia. In the future, we are certainly hoping that pemetrexed is funded, as we think this is a better tolerated drug in second line, and there's been some interesting work looking at maintenance treatment in adenocarcinoma. I've certainly had a patient that was able to access pemetrexed through a clinical trial, where they were actually looking at another oral treatment, which actually proved to be ineffective. But what it meant is this patient actually was able to access pemetrexed for 13 months. And although they actually had to end the treatment because of renal damage, which has actually reversed but was certainly significant at the time, they actually remain in clinical remission, getting on for 2 years from second-line treatment. I think this reflects the biology of her disease, but it's also very interesting that she has had an excellent response to this treatment, but at some cost. In the future, and as an international recommendation, we're looking at the role of ALK fusion testing, and this is something that you will hear more about. It is not currently funded in New Zealand, and it costs the patient about $500. If a patient is EGFR negative but has adenocarcinoma, a new international recommendation, although this is not being done universally and certainly not funded throughout the world, is that these patients should have ALK fusion test, because there's a drug called, and we think there's about 5% of our adenocarcinoma, so it's only a small subgroup of the patients, but they will be able to access crizotinib, which is another small oral targeted therapy with another side effect profile. That I think that we will be using in the future for a small subgroup of adenocarcinomas, not all adenocarcinomas. That earlier diagnosis and smoking cessation still have major contributions. So I think as oncologists or health practitioners, that smoking cessation and getting people to the doctors with coughs to try and diagnose them earlier and try and improve that figure or reduce that figure of 80% presenting with advanced disease down to, an improved figure, because resection or chemo radiation will still give the best outcomes. Early detection is the key. And I also hope that we've just looked at the essential role of palliative care, symptom control, particularly looking at the improvement in shortness of breath. And obviously we haven't talked about the role of advanced care planning, but I think certainly the trial in Canada was alluding to that, and I think putting the patient's wishes and getting that out there with all patients with advanced lung cancer will have definite benefits for them. And also I think that it's highlighted how do we measure a good outcome, and maybe one size doesn't fit all. So just as we're talking about tailoring our chemotherapy or our targeted treatments to lung cancer, that maybe how we measure people's outcome is really down to them. And whether you call it hospitalization or the place of death or whether going to ED really is bad for some people, I don't think that will fit all. But obviously, I think it's an interesting point. And finally, I'd just like to acknowledge the many people that I've had the privilege of looking after in New Zealand. For some of you, you may not realize that I'm actually moving back to the UK to undertake some research. And I do with a very happy heart coming nearer to my own family in whānau, but a very sad heart leaving a lot of amazing colleagues and, more importantly, patients and families have I've had the privilege to look after. I'd like to thank you all for listening, and I hope it's been reasonably clear, and be happy to answer any questions, and thank you for the palliative care colleagues I've had the privilege of learning from and sharing care with. And I'd also like to thank AstraZeneca for some of these slides. And for the technical support, although I'm sorry that I wasn't able to be visualized this morning. Thank you so much for listening, and please keep lung cancer patients, please keep offering excellent care to these lung cancer patients, because they really do deserve it. Thank you.